Here's to join me here. Those of you with questions, line up now. We'll have about 10 minutes time for discussion. Anticipating a rush to the microphones, I will begin first. I think the last speaker really touched on the essential issue. There are two reasons for making investments. One is self-interest and the other is moral. Can you tell me, how do you convert the moral imperative for research or investment in this sort of an arena into a self-interest?
You would start with a hard question, huh? I think that, I mean, part of it, what is self-interest, right? And so there's two things here. One thing that we're all concerned about is tenure, merit, increases in pay. And so part of the problem, and I think that we've all confronted this in different ways with more or less success, is that university structures have to also reinforce that, particularly for non-tenured faculty. You know, there shouldn't be a trade-off between doing policy-relevant work if the field of expertise is relevant to policymaking and the prospects for getting tenure. Later on, the prospects for promotion, for getting raises. So that's the first thing. The second thing, and this is altruism, this is my, you know, my wishing I was younger and could have been a hippie in the 60s kind of thing, is that why do we get involved in university education? And then the reason, I think, is hopefully, whether we succeed or not depends, is making the, is training a new generation of citizens, right? And I think that there's almost, there should be a moral imperative to getting involved. I think that the best people who are really have a vocation for being a university professor try and capture that. So I don't think it's as hard as it might seem. In flipping sides and looking at the global south, it's the same kind of thing. There, though, the imperatives are even greater because we have more resources once again. And so the need to get income oftentimes is something that's unavoidable.
Thank you. Dr. Kush.
This is for Dr. Gold. I enjoyed your talk. You focused on one side of a seesaw, or I don't know what you say in Canada, teeter-totter or whatever. And the other side is university intellectual property. And if I look at the weight of it, the heavy weight in terms of real discovery is at the university end, and the community and the indigenous knowledge is important, and it's socially relevant to try to create that kind of intellectual property. But I was disappointed that you didn't talk about the other end of the spectrum, because I think there's a huge amount of movement that's required at the university level for socially responsible management of intellectual property. And we at our institution, we've been pushing on this for a couple of years, and we now have a policy that is up before the Academic Council. If it goes through the Academic Council, it goes through the Council of Deans, and you know, universities have this incredible political structure, and you know, yada yada yada, and up to the university president. We expect it's going to go through, that we will have at the presidential level at the university a really fine policy with respect to it. So, could you address that part of it?
Thank you for the question. I rarely get accused of forgetting that part. I have a whole stack of presentations to address that issue. In terms of capacity building at home and how we think about intellectual property and our obligations as universities to ensure that our knowledge is disseminated and appropriately used, I did mention the little tidbit that most universities either break even or lose money on technology transfer. The myth that we make money from it is wrong. What we don't have yet, and some universities are starting to think this way, the best one in Canada by far would be the University of British Columbia, in terms of starting to think about the role of intellectual property should be to assist the process of getting the information to the people who can use it. And that sometimes means you patent, often means you don't. I'm also part of a group called the Structural Genomics Consortium, which brings together various players to put information in the public domain, and everybody is prohibited from obtaining a patent. It will be open to everyone. So there are some initiatives aimed at doing so. When I go to think about the training programs and capacity building in the Global South, the one thing I try to tell them not to do is think about intellectual property as a way to make money, but as a way to build the networks. Intellectual property, when you do obtain it, is a way to actually enter into a relationship as opposed to simply closing down relationships. And so I try to get them to avoid to think the way that Western universities have thought and try to think in a new way. But my short answer to you is, yes, I'm glad your university is moving in that direction. I wish other universities were doing so, including our own here. And there's lots more to be said.
Yes.
Universities, either in Wewetonongo or Nairobi, to be involved in the IP training, because it seems like they kind of got bypassed, and that would make things much more sustainable in terms of being able to train other communities aside from Hmong people or other groups.
In Guatemala, no, we didn't have a partner. The link was directly with the community, and there was a lot of distrust that they had among partners in the country, and so we stayed away from it. From that reason. In Kenya, however, our partners were the Faculty of Law at the University of Nairobi. The people who had been visiting us were people who were experts in patent law. And the co-trainers, the other people who helped us do it, even though they were at institutions, were working heavily in intellectual property policy. So one represents Kenya regularly in international fora where they're discussing intellectual property. So our preference is to use local experts and draw on them, whether very local or regional. But in the case of Guatemala, because we were just beginning our relationship, we didn't want to impose an external party on them.
We'll take one final question. Cota.
Hello, Dr. Oxhorn. Are there any kind of measures that could be taken to prevent miscommunication from differing perceptions?
Thanks for the question. I think that and it's easier now than it used to be because of email. But it's dialogue. Okay, so all of our projects revolve around face-to-face workshops, which is expensive too, but they're essential. And we try to alternate those workshops between, Canada, where the next one's going to actually be in Kigali, Rwanda. And I think that, like with my example of the no one can understand why there was a problem understanding the state, you just have to work these things out and talk about it. The worst thing that can happen is that people don't recognize the misperception. And so it's easier said than done sometimes because people have a kind of tunnel vision or they don't listen. But I think that collaboration also requires not only talking, but listening. In terms of measures, it's really the outcome that will be the ultimate determinant of success. And genuine collaboration really means that it has a legitimacy on both sides. Hope that's helpful.
At this time, before we thank the speakers, I will reiterate instructions for lunch. It is down the hall. You can probably smell it. Please collect your lunch and come back here with some alacrity, because we're behind time and we need to progress to our next keynote speaker. But before we depart, let us thank our three distinguished professors for their wonderful contributions. We got it.